Blog Talk Radio. Hi, this is Marnie Svedberg, and I welcome you to Marnie and Friends, a place where leaders share practical, helpful, and encouraging ways to get anything important done faster, better, and smarter. Right now, I encourage you to sit back, buckle up, and join us for fun, laughter, practical help, and clear thinking, the kind of discussion that focuses our attention off of the fluff and onto the most important stuff in life. Again, welcome to Marnie's Friends. Let's get going. Hi, everybody. This is Marnie, and I'm so excited to have you with us this afternoon for a wonderful program on how to tell a great story with our amazingly wonderful guest, Cease Murphy. He is a veteran author of co-written over 130 books, and that includes the New York Times best-selling book, 90 Minutes in Heaven with Don Piper, and also Gifted Hands, the Ben Carson story with Dr. Ben Carson. He has a book that is a 2013 release called Writer to Writer Lessons from a Lifetime of Learning with Oakterra Publishers, and he's here to share with us today about how to write or tell a really good story. Welcome to you, Cease.
Oh, thanks, Marnie. Glad to be with you.
And you guys can find out about him directly at his website, Cecil Murphy, CecilMurphey.com. Cecil, you say that you wrote your first story when you were 9 years old, and what do you remember about that?
Okay, I had seen a movie called Saboteur. It was an Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Okay.
I was just a kid, you know. And there's a scene that takes place where this woman is trapped in an office building, locked in, and she's on a skyscraper. So she opens the window, and she sees there's taxi cabs way down below. So she starts flashing her compact and writes a message saying that she's trapped, and she throws the message out on a piece of paper. And back then, I think the movie was made in the 40s, they see it, look up, set her free. And so that was so exciting. I decided to write a story, and I wrote a story saying, "Help, my husband is trying to kill me. I live at 1302 West 2nd Street." And I put it out in front of my house, and it seemed like I waited an hour, but I was a kid of 9 years old, so maybe it was like 3 minutes. But anyway, nothing happened. About a week later, I was in the corner grocery store with my mother, and there was owned by a woman named Mrs. DeRoos, and she and my mother were talking. Finally, she said, "Did you hear about the awful thing that happened over the apartments?" And my mother said, "What?" And she said, "Well, the police came banging on the door, and they said, this woman's husband was trying to kill her." And she started fighting them and arguing with them and so on. And finally, you know, she's talking about it, and I'm feeling guilty. Finally, I said,
"Oh no!" Oh.
I said, "Oh, I wrote that." Oh. And they told me to shut up, never tell anybody again. And after that, whenever I went into the store, Mrs. DeRoos would say, "Hi, Cease. Written any good murder mystery? Any good mysteries lately?"
And thus launched the beginning of an amazing writing career. You say that there are three gifts that you've been given as a writer, and one of them is that you're fast.
I am. The way I put it is I have really three gifts. I'm fast is one, speed is one, I'm highly self-disciplined, and I have a lot of energy. And, you know, God has brought the three of those together, and I think they work.
You know, you say you have a lot of energy. I don't want to spill the beans here, but do you want to tell us how old you are?
Oh, I don't mind. I'm 80 years old.
80 years old. And how much do you write every day?
Well, most of the time, 6 to 8 hours a day.
Wow. And when I look at this list of your upcoming titles for 2013, I am wowed by these, at least, what do you have coming out this year? Eight books?
Seven
books.
Come on, don't exaggerate here.
Yeah. Seven books. I was trying to count really fast as I was talking, but some of them had different lines in between. So when you come out with seven books in 1 year and you're 80 years old, and how do you stay creative?
I read a lot. Honestly, I read everything I can. I even read cereal boxes. I read ingredients on the labels of the drugstore. I don't remember what they are, but I read them. I'm compulsive.
Huh. So you read everything. And as you're reading, what are you taking special note of?
I don't know. It just, you know, Martin, here's what I felt many, many years ago when I first started writing. I thought, if I read, especially reading good writers, I will absorb what I need to know. And I feel that I've learned more from reading other writers to see how they did it than anything I've never taken any formal writing classes, actually.
Wow.
So, but I've always been a reader, and I love stories.
That's so cool. So if you were gonna prescribe for someone who's just an early writer, an exercise that they could do, would you know what to prescribe for them?
Yeah, you know, I really had never thought about it until you asked me. Because,
okay,
you know, some of these things I just do.
Sure.
I got four steps. Start with an intriguing beginning, and I'm glad to talk more about that. Build suspense. Withhold as much information as you can. That's the second one. Build suspense. Third, build toward the punchline. And four, give them a takeaway that's memorable.
And is this... I'm going to have you repeat those in just a second for everybody, but is this the same whether it's a short story or like a full-blown book?
Anything.
It works for everything.
This is what I do with books. All right, let me give you an example. I said, start with the beginning. Little Women, I don't know if you've ever read that, but see, I even read books like that. I don't remember the exact words, but it starts out with something like, it won't be Christmas this year without presents. And you hear that? It's a very simple, intriguing beginning. It's not heavy laden. It's not heavy drama, but it invites readers into the story. Here's another one. I started an article. I couldn't understand why the Africans didn't remember their kindness toward me. See, I'm just giving you something to make you think and to draw it in.
Right. So, okay, so an intriguing beginning. What was the second one?
The second one is build suspense. Withhold as much information as you can.
Yep. And how do you actually do that while developing a scene?
Well, let me give you, maybe I can give you kind of an example. I get these stories all the time because, you know, I've done some compilations. And one of the things the publishers always ask me to do, well, I don't think always, when I started with these, I had a St. Martin's Press, which is a New York house, offered me a contract to write a book of compilations and said, you can get the stories, but every story has to sound like you. So let me just give you a couple of beginnings that came to me from people. I won't mention their names.
Okay.
Here's one. It was the most awful Christmas of my life until an angel came to my door. I've got it. I've got the story. Why do I want to read the rest of it?
Right.
Here's another. I'm living proof that what Satan intended for harm, God intended for good. I got that one, too. Here's another one. Fuzzy sat bolt upright on the gurney in the last cubicle of the emergency room where death awaited him. He thrashed wildly, like Lazarus peeling away the wrappings of death and walking from his tomb. Fuzzy returned from the dead. Oh, I got the story.
Wow.
I read that quite fast, but he's on the gurney. Suddenly he's thrashing around. He's coming from the dead. Okay, I got the story. What do I need to read the rest of it?
Right. I think when we were talking back a couple weeks ago, see, that was the thing that really struck me that I'd been doing really wrong with my storytelling that really stole the thunder at the end. I gave away too much at the beginning. Yeah.
And that's, you're so eager for them to get it. Let me try something else, Marnie. Can you tell a joke?
I can only tell a joke if I think it's hilariously funny, then I can. But otherwise, if I only think it's mildly funny, then I can't.
Okay. See, if you can tell a good joke, you can tell a good story.
Okay.
Because good jokes depend on the punchline and the takeaway. Right?
Right. Okay. So good jokes depend on the punchline. I'm taking notes, of course.
Oh, okay.
the takeaway. And that's the same with the story. Right.
Yes.
We have to have a takeaway. In fact, you know, one of the stories that I have that doesn't really fly very well is because I'm not really clear about the takeaway. And what do you do if your story doesn't have a really big takeaway?
Well, then you make it really strong. And let me get, here's an example. Jonathan Livingston, the missionary to Africa.
Okay.
Here's how an article ended that I wrote. "Where are you prepared to go?" his inquisitor asked. "I'm prepared to go anywhere," he said, "as long as it's forward."
Hmm.
See, I don't need to give you a takeaway. You get it.
Right. Is that another thing that we do wrong a lot of times when writing stories? Is we kind of act like people are dumb and they can't get it?
That's right. And we, you know, I always figure that readers are as bright or brighter than I am.
Okay. Yep. Right. Yeah, and I think that we tend on one extreme or the other. We don't have a takeaway, or otherwise we beat it over the head.
Yeah, and or we start applying it before we really get to the end of it. Mm-hmm. Or we start, see, a lot of times when people start telling stories, they tell too much. Here's something to help. R-U-E, Rue, resist the urge to explain.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you really want to tell a good story, cut it to the minimum. Now, I'm talking short stories, articles, that kind of thing. Books a little different, but resist the urge to explain. So you get it in there, and then when you finish, you can, you know, Jesus was talking to these that people about the Good Samaritan, tells a story, and he says, go and do likewise. But if you read that story, there's very little explanation.
Right.
It's
just an example, really.
Yeah, and the emphasis is on the action. Or here's one of my favorite Old Testament parable is Nathan confronting David, and he said, "You are the man."
You are that man.
You know, there's more to it than that. It happens afterward, but you get the point.
Well, I think about my favorite Bible stories. You know, you've got little Joseph having a vision, and it's years later, after all kinds of trauma, that he ends up one day going from prison to the top. Second in command in the country.
Right.
You know, and you've got these riveting Bible stories. I always wonder, you know, this is a little off topic, but I've got you here, so I'm going to ask you. When Hollywood makes a movie about the Bible, and they change it all up and they embellish it and everything, to me, when I read the Bible stories, they are the most riveting stories of anything.
It's true, you know, but you've got to remember, we bring things into a story when we read it. And if you don't have an imagination, Hollywood has to help. They're trying to help us get it.
Okay.
I wouldn't even discuss it. I think that it's important for them to make this meaningful. Sometimes they make it too meaningful. I remember years ago there was a film called The Prodigal with Lana Turner. And, you know, he went to a far country and wasted his money. There was 80 pages of dialogue about that one. Just that sentence.
Oh. Yep. So maybe overkill a little bit on some of it.
Yeah. But they were trying to make a commercial movie to build characterization. You know, even like a movie, an hour and a half, 2 hour movie, you got to build in things that aren't, that the imagination or research or both bring in. But that's a little different from writing a story.
And how?
Well, when you write a story, particularly if I'm writing just a short story or an article, I want to give you an illustration. This is a metaphor, a picture to tell you about life. And, you know, I want to get to you quick, and I want to build a suspense, give you a punchline, and let you walk away with it.
Okay.
Let me give you an example,
yeah.
May I?
Yeah.
This is about my wife. Hmm. We lived in Africa. Let me try another way, because I'll tell you all you're not without setting us up for you. Shirley and her African friend Margaret held a conference near Lake Victoria. When Shirley walked in, she saw this little girl who was dirty and filthy, so she picked a little girl up. She just felt compassion for her, picked her up, put her on her lap, and just felt she wanted to be with this little girl. And she said to somebody, "What's your name?" And they said, "Oh, she doesn't have a name." Shirley said, "What do you mean she doesn't have a name?" And they said, "Well, she had them. It's been so long we've forgotten. So she doesn't talk. She fell in the fire when she was a child, and she's just really stupid. So we just call her you." you know. And Shirley made her felt even more compassionate. So for the 3 days she was there, Shirley held that little girl as often as she could. When he ate, she'd sit with the little girl next to her and sometimes even feed her. And the whole time, on the day they left, they packed the VW, prepared to leave, and little no-name ran up to the car, jumped on the running board, and she said, "Ahedy." And she's talking. One of the women said, "She's talking. She's never talked since we've known her," the family said. And soon about 20 women were gathered around, marveling at the words of the child. "It's a miracle. It's a miracle." Here's my punchline. And it was a miracle. And perhaps just as great a miracle was what she said to Shirley, "Ahedy, I love you."
Oh, my. Oh, yeah.
So you got it, didn't
you're
you?
So good at this.
Well, I don't know. I just like to tell stories.
You do, and you just have such a gift for it, and I'm so grateful that you're sharing some of that gift with us today. Okay, let's jump back. I want you to go back and tell us the 4 points again. It was, number one, an intriguing beginning. Number two, build suspense.
Three, build toward the punchline. See, it isn't just building suspense. You're building and you're aiming at something.
Yeah. And number four?
Give them a takeaway that's memorable.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, not just, that's the day I met God. That's not very memorable. But that's the day God punched a hole in my dream. That's memorable.
See, so when you are envisioning, do you like see pictures of stories in your mind, or are you more wordsy? How does it work for you?
Well, kind of both. You know, I sort of see the pictures in my head. But, you know, I also love to listen to other people tell stories or, you know, tell my own of experiences I've had. And one of the things that I do when I give illustrations is, you know, you tell a story, and people don't always end with nice, even, memorable words. And so I think one of the liberties we're allowed is to, you know, tighten it up so that it has the real punch without making it 50 words long.
Yeah.
And so what I do here, think of stories, and I want to keep it true. I don't just make up things. I want to keep it true unless I say, here's
right.
a story. You know.
Sure, right.
And then I cut it down in as few words as possible. Here, can I give you another illustration?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I went back to Africa after 14 years. By the way, I was a missionary in Africa for 6 years. And I met with several pastors, and we talked for hours, and I kept saying to them, they kept saying to me, "Do you remember when you did this?" "No, I didn't." Julie said, "I didn't have any money, and you loaned me money so my kids could go to school, and then when I couldn't pay you back, you forgave me." And another one said, my wife was pregnant, the baby was breached, and you drove us 50 miles in the rainy season to a hospital, and she was able to deliver the baby," and went on and on like that. And I was listening, and I thought, you know what, I don't really remember that. And then when it was a pause, I said, "Yeah, but Julie, do you remember when I first came here, you helped me with the language. There wasn't any written vocabulary, so you helped me." He said, "I did? I don't remember that." And this went on and on for quite a while. Finally, Blasio Weri was sitting there. He had this puzzled look on his face, and then he smiled and he said, "Ah, now I see. Those who give must never remember. Those who receive must never forget."
Oh, wow. Wow.
See, just his words. He said a lot more than that. You understand?
Sure. Okay. All right. So that's what you mean. He said a lot more. He went on and on. But you just narrowed it down to just straight at the punchline there.
Exactly right. See, I wanted you to give a punchline, and it has its own takeaway. See,
so
if you hear, "Those who give must never remember. Those who receive must never forget." Isn't that a takeaway?
I mean, that's a plaque.
Yeah. You're right.
We have a retail store, and I buy plaques for our retail stores, and some of them are so great. I have one on my wall right now. "Life is not measured by the number of breaths you take, but by the moments that take your breath away." I mean,
okay, that's very good.
Yeah, right. There's these sayings, and the one you just said was one of those, where, I mean, you just should look at them every day. You really should.
Well, one of the things that I do, Marnie, I have a little newsletter, and as well as a blog for writers and so on. And what I try to do, I just fell into this, is to summarize the blog entry or the newsletter in one sentence. For instance, you know that my wife died, and the one sentence I put there is, or the first words that came out of my heart when somebody asked me how things were, I said, "The pain is deep, the peace is deeper." See, that's
so
a takeaway.
Yeah.
And what I mean, it wasn't planned, it just popped out.
Wow, that is so beautiful. You know, and people can get a hold of those at your website, right?
CecilMurphy.com? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Or just email me, cec.murp at comcast.net, and I'll give them my newsletter, or they can just look me up online. But I try to always give people a kind of a brief two or three sentences. You mentioned my book, Writer to Writer.
Yeah.
Even in giving instructions for writing, every entry ends with what I call an aphorism or a maxim, just a little something. They're not quite terribly brilliant because it's a restricted area, restricted field, but I try to give people something they can think about.
Just love it. You model that. When I come to your website, on the front page, you give me in whatever it is, you know, I don't want to exaggerate now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 words. you give me how you want me to feel at your site. You say, "I want to hug people with my words." And see, when you speak and when you write, that is how I feel. I feel the genuine love of Christ flow through you, even if it's just in a sentence.
What a perceptive person you are. That was meant to be funny.
Oh, good. I'm not sure if I should burst out laughing. Or
no. Well,
I don't
want
to laugh at you.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying. See, okay, look, listen to that sentence. "I want to hug people with my words." See, that invites you in to my website.
Right.
It doesn't say to you, "If you want to be a writer, here are the 12 things you need to know." Or, "You'll probably never make it as a writer, but I'm going to give you some tips anyway." See, those aren't, or the people I find the most difficult are those who give me these ponderous statements with big, big words. You know, people want the simple, the easy words.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, would anybody misunderstand, "I want to hug people with my words"? I mean, it's
pretty
simple.
Straightforward. Yeah. Yeah.
And straightforward is another word. That's pretty much who I am.
Yeah, you are. That's right. And I think that's critically important, is that it resonates with who you are. I mean, if you are, you know, if you are the theologian and you are pontiferous and like that, then you should probably use words like that, because that's going to resonate. But when you are someone who has maxims, who has these little nuggets of truth, that's what I think they are. I think they're nuggets of truth, and you throw them so freely, Cece. I love that about you.
Well, you know, and they really just kind of come natural. Now, I will tell you that I used to read books of aphorisms. I get a couple of blogs where they end a little quote, famous quote at the end, and I read those. And you know, after a while, you learn to just kind of think that way. At least I do. I have about 700 of these little maxims that I've written.
Do you have a book of those yet?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a book of those yet?
Well, I haven't put it into a book. I might one day. I did a book a couple of years ago called Knowing God, Knowing Myself. Mm. And none of the chapters are more than 3 pages long. And at the end of every chapter, I put a maxim or an aphorism. For instance, here's the first one. This came at a very, very meaningful time in my life. I was really struggling with, "God, I work so hard and nothing's happening," you know, that kind of thing. And so here's the word that came to me. I had to massage it a couple of times, but here's the way it came out. "I am passionately involved in the process. I am emotionally detached from the result."
Oh, so good. Oh, say it again.
I am passionately involved in the process. I am emotionally detached from the result.
I love that.
And I work at that.
For some of you listening, you're like, what? You can't do that. You can't become detached from the result. Otherwise, you're not really involved. But I agree with you, Cece, that that is the place of peace.
Yeah, you know, I think the problem with most of us, I think the more zealous we are for Jesus Christ, the more we not only want to work for God, we also want to determine how it's going to end.
Right.
See, and that's not right. Our role.
Right, it's not our role. Right.
Well, I read an article, a sermon by Charles Spurgeon, this wasn't the point he was making, but he pointed out that all God expects of us to do is to do what we can do. And he said, the fisherman throws the net into the sea. He doesn't make the fish, and he doesn't bring the fish into the net. He just does what he knows to do.
Right.
So I translated that into these words here.
I have this thing I'm doing, Cece. If you envision a whiteboard in front of you, a big whiteboard, and then
okay,
and then draw a line in the middle of it, okay?
Okay.
And on the top half of the whiteboard, make a little circle in the middle, and on the bottom half, make a little circle in the middle. And on the top half in that circle, write God's stuff. And on the bottom half, write my stuff. And then on the God side, I had things like, you know, war, financial collapse of the United States, heaven, you know, things that were really beyond me, just slightly, obviously. And then on the bottom half, my stuff, I would put things like, you know, little financially tight, or a concern about one of the kids, or, you know, these things that come to my mind. And so what I began to do is I began to visually grab the things from the bottom half of the whiteboard and move them up to the top half. And on my way up, I would do just what you said right there. I would say, God, I know you're busy, but I'm just going to have to give you this right now because I don't seem to be able to have any effect on it. And so I'm just going to give it to you. And then coming down on the other side, I asked him, you know, is there anything you want me to do about that right now? And most of the time, peace and calm, quiet, nothing. I was supposed to do nothing except just give it to him. But sometimes I was supposed to pray about it. Sometimes I was supposed to take action on it. And I just love living like that, and that's what you're talking about here.
Okay, and you've just illustrated my point. You started by inviting us in to talk about your whiteboard. You told us the problem. You gave us a solution. And then you end up by saying, so I sort of got, okay, is there anything you want me to do about it? That's memorable.
Hmm.
You did it.
I did it.
Don't tell me you can't tell stories.
Yay. You already healed me. Jeez. This is awesome. Okay, let's go back up to the top here. Our hour is going away. So let's go back up to the top. Intriguing beginning. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add, or did we cover that one?
I think we've covered it. The main thing with the beginning is, let me try another thing. Another thing I think you need to do is to think about your audience. Who is going to read this? When I write an illustration, maybe I'm not as spiritual as some people, but my purpose is to bring enjoyment or meaning to the reader, to the listener. And I'm serious. That's the way I would say it. I want to bring enjoyment or meaning to them. And so consequently, I don't embarrass or confuse anybody, you know, confuse them or try to make them uncomfortable. I'm just not a guilt inducer. And I don't tell a story about some member of the audience or write a story about somebody at the expense of someone.
Right.
Just so I can tell a great story.
Right.
And here's another question. Here's one thing I teach people to do. Ask yourself, will my readers care?
Yeah, right.
Do I leave something out? If it's important, then put it in. But if I leave it out, some side issue, will readers even notice? Will readers care? And the fact that it's, I say it as a side issue, says generally you're saying, not really. And the other thing is, I say, don't bring up inside jokes and stories. Now, I sometimes I've done a few novels. I sometimes plant inside jokes, and I know they're inside jokes, and they're only for the few people who know me well and can laugh at them. For instance, I did a novel called Everybody Called Her a Saint. There's a scene in there where a fellow opens up a bag with some books in it, with book covers, and he realizes that the books aren't, the covers in the books aren't the same. But I list five of the titles of those books, and they're books that I wrote.
Oh.
but only people who know me would know that. And it's just my little
That's
joke.
Great. That's great. So you can actually build an insider joke if you don't leave people out. So like that one, nobody would know that you had an inside joke attached to it. How fun is that? That's great.
Okay,
let me try
something else from the beginning. I want to tell you a couple things never to say or never to. I was at a meeting a couple months ago, and this man was a long, boring speaker. I mean, really boring. And he went 27 minutes. He was only supposed to go 7. And after about 12 minutes, he said, "Now I have a few hilarious stories to tell you."
Oh, no. Well, is that setting the expectation a little high?
Yeah, hilarious stories. Nobody laughed the whole time. I mean, there were cute little stories, but they weren't.
They weren't hilarious.
Well, they weren't even. They were barely cute.
So
anytime you tell me what you're going to do, like, "I'm going to entertain you now." Okay.
Oh,
see, you're already off the stage. Get out of here.
Hmm.
So you don't tell them what you're going to tell them. I know I've heard people say, "Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you've done, told them." Yeah, maybe, but that's kind of boring.
That's really not storytelling. That's more like a pedagogue. I mean, that's more like in a classroom where you're really trying to get them to memorize the information. I mean, that's
memorize
that
is a good point, or learn it by rote. Yeah, memorize, good point. What I want to do, you mentioned hugging people. The way I don't think so much hugging as I think of myself as coming at you with my arms wide open.
Yeah, right.
And I'll say, "Okay, here's what I want to give you. This is for you."
Hmm.
So if you think of the readers or your listeners, I think your stories will always be stronger.
This is for you. I'm writing that down. This is for you. Who is it for? Yeah, and we got to identify that first. Who is it really for?
Yeah.
And then how is my – and I always go back to resonance again, too. Is that really am I really honestly writing it for them, or am I writing it because I wanted to just get it off my chest, or why am I writing it anyway? This should be for them. Yeah. A gift.
Yeah, you know, I've had a couple of books that failed, and one of them was I write gift books for Harvest House, and one of them failed, and I knew it was going to fail, and I tried to tell them, but they asked me to write it. It was on Ecclesiastes 3. There's nothing wrong with that, except they never identified the audience they wanted me to write for. They said, "Oh, just give us some words about, from Ecclesiastes to,
right,
you know, explain it." Well, I did, and I think it's okay. People who actually read it, and there aren't very many, but those who actually read it say, "Yeah, it's okay," but there's no identifiable audience.
Right. So it doesn't ever come to life because you weren't relating to anyone in particular.
Well, at least the title is called Hope and Comfort for Every Season. Now, just think about that.
Right, right.
Think about it. Hope and Comfort for Every Season. Wow, isn't that an exciting title?
Right. Okay.
See,
right.
And so I don't identify the audience. But I did another book for them called When Someone You Love No Longer Remembers.
Mm-hmm.
Now the audience is identified.
Or your new book this year, Saying Goodbye. Right.
That's right.
Right.
Saying Goodbye, and the subtitle is Facing the Loss of a Loved One.
Yeah.
See, I've identified the audience. You wouldn't pick it up unless it was something you were interested in.
Right. Right,
but
which
hope
is how
and comfort for every season.
Too broad. Yawn. Okay. No. Okay. So number two, let's go on to building suspense. I think you covered that pretty well. Is there anything else that you had in mind that you wanted to share with us?
No. Only I gave this thing about Livingston. I want you to hear one thing. And this is just a very slight example, but it's to give readers chance to absorb. So sometimes when I tell a story, I will put two sentences, but I'll put something in the middle, like he said, or give you an illustration. Here's the Jonathan Livingston again. "Where are you prepared to go?" the inquisitor asked. "I'm prepared to go anywhere," he said, "as long as it's forward." See, this is very subtle, but notice the pause between the two statements. "I'm prepared to go anywhere as long as it's forward." That, just to say it that way is like, oh, yeah, okay. But if you stick, he said, in the middle, you've sort of said, "I'm prepared to go anywhere as long as it's forward." Then it has real impact.
Okay, and you know what? You had to actually explain that whole thing out before I caught even what you were doing there.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
So small, but yet you're right. I mean, it forces you to breathe. It forces you to pause.
Yeah, or my other favorite way is to kind of give people a little trick at the end, a little surprise. For instance, when I was a pastor, here's a prayer I prayed with my congregation. And now, in order for me to give you this, Marnie, you got to repeat it after me, okay?
Okay.
Loving God.
Loving God.
Show me the truth about myself.
Show me the truth about myself.
No matter how beautiful it may be.
No matter how beautiful it may be.
But see, you caught it at the end. See, I haven't prayed that. I have them follow me because that's the pause.
Right, exactly. And it's not what you're expecting. It is the suspense there because you're like, oh, no, what's it going to make me say?
See? Yeah. All right, you got it. See, I like doing that one, that kind of thing. And in fact, it got so that every once in a while, somebody in the congregation would say, can we pray that prayer today?
Right. Right, because we don't allow ourselves to actually pray that one.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of selfish. But... or maybe not selfish, maybe proud or something.
Well, or we just don't know what we're doing.
Which is normal.
Yeah. Here's something. Now, this isn't original. I stole it somewhere, but I don't remember where. But there's an acronym called CAR, C-A-R. C-A-R, Context, Action, Result.
Okay.
Context. So this is one of the things you want to get very early in your story. Where and when does a story happen? People want details. You know, we live in a culture, maybe this is true all to the world, we want to know the time and the place. It just seems to be so basic. You ever start reading a book and you think, where is that taking place? Or is this the present time? You know, and there's nothing in there to tell you. So the context is very important. Just set it as quickly as possible. The second, what happens? What's the turning point? The climax? What are you building to? And the third one is the result. Okay, here's why I told you the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've sort of said all that, but that's just a different way of doing it.
Yeah. What was the hardest book you ever wrote?
All of them. The hardest... well, I won't tell you the person, but it was I make most of my living as a ghostwriter. I write for other people.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, I was called a ghostwriter because my name did not appear, and this was one of them. Now I'm called a collaborator because it's so-and-so with
Lisa Murphy. Sure, sure.
Okay, well, this is one of those, my name does not appear, for which I am grateful.
Okay.
And the person I worked with was really absolutely difficult.
Hmm.
He was lazy. See, what I do is I write a book, I write the first draft, I work with them till I get all the information. Then I write a draft, send it to them, ask them to make the corrections. He wouldn't do that. He made me come to his office. Okay. He sat in one corner of the room, his secretary sat in the other corner, and I was in the middle, and they both went through it sentence by sentence to changes. Wait a minute. Three times we did this, drafts. And I worked on it. And finally, at the end, in his acknowledgments, he thanked me for writing the first draft of the book.
Wow.
But he was a celebrity type, and he was kind of used to people bowing down to him. And I just don't do that. And that may have had been a factor. But it took me about three times as long to write his book as I should have.
Did you change then in the future what clients you took on?
Well, actually, I took him because, number one, my agent said he asked me to take it, and I knew the person, and I thought it would be a good story, and I knew a little bit of his story. I just didn't realize how difficult it was going to be. But here's what I have done since then. I do not accept an assignment on a book until I've met the person personally.
There you go.
Yeah, may I give you another example. Just recently, I finished the first draft of a book. This is a woman who was caught up in sexual trafficking, human trafficking, four times. She later escaped. By the way, she was a high school. She was an eighth grade dropout. She got her GED, and got education. And this month, she is receiving her PhD.
Oh wow!
Yeah, but I met the woman. And at a conference, and she kept saying to me, I really feel God wants you to write this book for me. But I hear that all the time.
Right, right.
Yeah. I didn't know until I talked to her, and there's something resonated within me, and I thought, this is a good story.
Mm.
And so I wrote a proposal, sold the book. Comes out next year. And we already have a company trying to do movie,
the
movie version. Yeah.
So cool. Well, and there you did it. Okay, so what you did is you told us that story. You did the inviting, intriguing beginning, you know, she's been trafficking, then you built suspense for us, and then you built toward your punchline, which was that this is going to be a good book. Because of what you did in the foreground, this was going to be a good book. Talk about a little bit more about building toward the punchline. What are some of the things that you use to do that?
Well, the simpler is withhold information. Make the reader begin to ask questions. Well, wait a minute, what happened next? Or did they do this? Some people just don't bother to tell it. But you start at a place to get people interested and intrigued. Here, another story. In 1984, I wrote a book called The Woman on Death Row. True story. Woman was convicted of killing one man. She confessed to three more. Okay? And she was going to be executed by lethal injection. So how do I start this book? See, that's the question. So I asked people, if you were going to write this, where would you start? And the one they nearly always say, well, I would put her on the gurney or, you know, just as she's getting injection. And I said, what a hard, negative beginning. I wouldn't read a book where a person is dying on page one, you know, the heroine of the story. And, how about the judge pronouncing the sentence?
Still pretty hard.
That work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, would I care about this woman? So, you know, I let them give all their answers, and finally I said, here's how I started the story, because I thought about all those. I have the story start with the sheriff coming to her home and arresting her for murder, and she's shocked. You go 100 pages into the book before you realize that she did it.
Oh.
See, but by then you like her.
Oh.
See, if I tell you, this is a woman who murdered people. She actually put arsenic, rat poison, in the iced tea of her victims. Because apparently it's very sweet. I've never tasted it myself, but they tell me
good
it's
job.
Very sweet. Yeah. But a very, very painful death as well. So, that's what she did. But if I start telling about on such and such a date, Velma Barfield was executed for murder, who cares?
Right.
See, the story will only be good if I make you identify with her and realize here's a woman that you can care about. And the thing I bring out very early in the book is that she was addicted to drugs. And doctors treat women rather shabbily in the 70s and 80s by... You know, I'm telling them to complain, not every time, but regularly women would complain, and so they'd give them tranquilizers or painkillers.
Right.
And she was going to 25 doctors at one time.
Oh, my goodness.
So no wonder she had a messed up mind.
Wow.
Yeah. But, see, did you hear what she just said? See, now you've sympathized with this woman,
right.
don't
oh,
you?
Oh, right, exactly. And the other thing is that right away when you said the name of the book, I was curious, well, is she guilty or is she not guilty? And
uh-huh.
the woman on death row doesn't tell me if she's guilty. It just tells me she's on death row. So right away from even the title, you had me, you know, intrigued.
Oh,
okay.
I like you. You're very perceptive.
Oh, I'm so quick. See, building toward the punchline, is there anything you want to avoid? Like any pitfalls that everybody falls into, like new writers?
Well, I think one thing I've noticed is that if they get that far and it's doing fairly well, the problem is they tend to want to rush through it.
Okay.
Let me give you a sentence orally. If I'm telling an oral story, and I wasn't even aware of this until I just got a letter a few months ago from a young woman. She was a teenager when I was a pastor, and she was telling me how much she learned from my preaching. She said, what I like most about you is when you would tell us a story, and if you'd get to the very end, most preachers would shout out what you're trying to say. She said, you would soften your voice and lean forward. And she said that I would lean forward to hear it.
Right, right.
Well, yeah. That's the way good stories are, whether leaning forward in an oral context or, you know, visually leaning forward. It's like you're trying to draw it out. And if I tell you too much or keep it or shout the answer, I'm really kind of insulting you, I think.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, take the story of David and Nathan. What if I told the story? And so, you know, the story about this man, the rich man had all these animals, and somebody came to dinner, so he stole a pet of a poor man. And, you know, I could say, see, that's just the way rich people work. They steal from the poor, and they take their good things. And so finally when Nathan looked at David, he said, you're the man.
Right.
Well, isn't that exciting? Don't you feel affirmed by that?
Right. Right, which is kind of moving into the fourth one here, which was give them the takeaway that's memorable. And, you know, that story, like you just described, could have gone so differently than it did. What are some of the stories maybe that you've had the hardest time coming up with that closure at the end?
Well, let me just tell you this. Anytime I use a story, write a book, give an illustration, I don't, this shows how peculiar I am, I don't write until I already know the end.
Okay.
I just know how it's going to end. Then I know I have it. If I can't figure out how it's going to end, then I'm not ready to write it.
Ah, there you go. That's really helpful. Thank you for just saying that out loud. Because, I mean, that is part of my problem, is that if I don't have the end, I have a really hard time writing the story. If I have the end, yeah, I think that's how my brain works too, maybe. You and me, peculiar people.
All right, I told a story one day, wrote a story about trusting my negative feelings and so on, and how I, you know, and I didn't know if they were true or not. Anyway, it's a longer story, but here's how I ended it. My negative feelings are emotions. My negative feelings are not reality.
Right.
See, I've built it. That is your takeaway. You get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. See, if the takeaway is simple and direct, you don't have any trouble understanding it. But have you ever read a story and you get to the end, you think, huh? What?
Yeah, well, it does. Right, it leaves you, there's this empty feeling like, okay, I think I understood that whole thing, but I wonder what I was supposed to do with that information. Right.
Right, or why have you ever watched a movie or read a book and you think, they didn't end it, they just stopped.
Right.
And there's a difference.
Right,
An ending gives you something that you take away.
Yeah.
And if something you leave, even if you don't like what you get at the end, at least it's wrapped up enough that you feel the story is complete. I just watched some movie the other night about some kind of school shooting, something like Columbine. But at the end, there's a guy standing there with a gun, looks like he's going to shoot a young couple. They're all students. And it ends. That's the end. he's already killed half a dozen people, and he's standing there with a gun against him, and it's the end.
I know. Whenever I see something like that, I always think they're planning on making another movie. I mean, it's not the end. That's what I think.
Okay, but see, then they're cheating you because they're saying to you, let's say that's their purpose. See, then that's dishonest.
Huh.
See, they're saying, I'm not going to give you the end. I want you to get ready so you can get in, you get it in the second edition. Or it might be the third or the fourth or the fifth. But see, that's not fair. When I read a story, I want a conclusion. I want something to take away with me.
You know, I wonder if you have an opinion on this. I kind of think you do, but... the stories where they actually, like the movies where they actually want to do a sequel, I think that they would have just as many people come back or more people come back for the second one if they didn't end you without the end. I mean, if they actually concluded that and then started a new story based on, you know, what you know about the people from the first story.
All right, let me give my favorite illustration is the movie Rocky. Won an Academy Award when it came out. It was Sylvester Stallone. And I don't like boxing. I think it's a horrible sport, but I watched the movie anyway. It's the first movie I've been in where people stood up and cheered in the audience. Because there's a conclusion. He wins. The underdog wins. See, you get the message, even though nobody said, hey, look, the underdog won. Nobody says that. It's dialogue. But we got it. The story was over. And how many Rockies came after that? Four or five of them. But the first one was complete. If it never written, never done another one, we would still have been satisfied with the ending.
Right, right.
Violent as it is, but it's still a satisfying ending.
So is there anything else? Like, I think you've spoken to integrity here probably three or four times specifically during this hour. That's really a big one for you.
It is, and let me tell you one other thing. As long as I get you in my integrity, one of the things that really bothers me about stories that I read and I hear is that too many people always make themselves the hero of their stories. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, except that sometimes people tell the stories as though it happened to them, and I've heard it or read it somewhere else, so I know it's not a literal story.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. I was at a Christian retail show 4 or 5 years ago, and this man, a well-known preacher, told a story about a preacher in Ireland, and boy, it was a powerful story. And a few months later, I read it in a book, and I knew the guy who wrote the book, and I said to him, did this really happen to you? And he said, oh, yeah. And I mentioned the writer who had given this speech. He said, well, he read my book, and we talked about that story. But when he told that man, preached it from the pulpit, he told it as though he had been in Ireland, and it was in the story.
Wow.
See, not only is that dishonest,
right?
Well, it is dishonest, but
right.
But there are two things to say about this. The first is the dishonesty, and second, too many people feel like they have to always be the hero of their story.
Hmm.
Do you remember I told you the story about the Africans and what Blasio said, those who give must never remember? See, I'm not the hero of that story.
Right.
See, I'm just one of the people there, but when you heard it, did it make any difference to you? They say, oh, well, Caesar's the one who's here, but brilliant or insightful. See, I think the story has more impact because, bless you, enough, if I were really spreading the story out, I would tell you they only had a third-grade education, so how insightful this man is. Well, my point that I want to make is that we don't have to be the heroes of our stories. What we have to do is tell a good story, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I wonder now, when you say that, if you have a story that doesn't have someone saying, like in some of your stories that you've shared today, you have a little girl saying, I love you. You have these wonderful endings to the story. Do you sometimes like borrow, like say, as the old saying goes, or as it says in Proverbs, or, you know, do you sometimes end it with something just completely that wasn't involved in the story at the time but makes perfect sense as a conclusion?
No, I don't, unless I tell you. For instance, the story I told you about the little girl, little no-name girl,
yeah.
That really happened. Now, the creativity came in is I said the miracle was, you know, everybody was complaining about her talking. See, and the point that my wife told me this, the thing that touched her the most is when she said the word "aheri," could we both know the language, which is the Luo language for "I love you." Now, I could have just said, she said to Shirley, "I love you." That's
right.
Okay. It works. But why not build the story?
Again, right.
See,
right.
She talked. Everybody's excited because here's this little girl that nobody ever heard talk before. And so I called that the miracle. But the greater miracle were the words she spoke.
Yeah.
See, I don't think that's violating integrity. I think I was just giving you the story, but doing it creatively.
Sure. Right. Oh, no, I think so, too. I guess I was just wondering about those times when there isn't a spoken word at the end to use. And
well, okay, then let me tell you how I do that. And I would say, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, I do not do that in print. I tell the story, and I said, I've reflected on that story, it makes me think of.
Okay, so yeah, so that is a legitimate way to end then.
Absolutely legitimate.
Yep. Yep.
And that doesn't claim any kind of divine inspiration. It just says, you know, it just reminds me of something.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, and I admire people who are willing to do that instead of saying something brilliant. And so I looked at him and I said, blah, 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 you know, quote a scripture
right.
verse.
Right.
But what if they didn't?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I just
life isn't always so squeaky clean like that.
Well, you know, I think of brilliant things to say afterward.
Right, exactly. Most of us do. Yeah, I wish I would have said that, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, this hour has just flown by, and I hope that you guys got as much out of this as I did. I learned so much. I always do see you are such a... you're such a generous spirit. I love you, and I love your generous spirit.
Let me give you a Bible verse. Okay.
Okay.
Now this is the King James Version, and it's Jubilations 4:4. Yea, the Lord shoveleth it in, I shoveleth it out, and behold, the Lord hath a larger shovel.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that. Jubilation. I've never read that book, but I want to.
Well, it's not the Bible, it ought to be.
Yeah, right. Should be. Oh, this is so great. And you guys, if you didn't catch it all, you can just go back and listen to the archive afterwards. Thank you, Cease, for being here. So grateful.
Thank you.
All right. You guys can find out more about our guest today, Cecil Murphy. CECILMURPHEY at cecilmurphy.com. And be sure to sign up for his newsletter and read his blog. Lots of great stuff over there. Also, you can check out the writing training over at marnie.com and find lots of great stuff over there. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you have a lovely, lovely rest of the day, and we'll see you next time. Successfully maximizing the gifts God has given us is the best gift that we can give back to God. Are you 100% clear about why you're here, about how God defines success for you personally? Are you on track with God's plan for your life, the best life on planet Earth followed by the best possible eternity for you? If not, check out the Success Principles Intensive Training course over at marnie.com. It's a 6-hour online program that will change how you define and do your life from today forward. It's a biblical based approach to goal setting and achievement. So check it out under the training tab at marnie.com.